I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
August 19, my husband and I were woken up by a telephone call. It was 6:30 in the morning.
It's August 1991, and Masha Lipman had just started working for the Washington Post in Moscow.
I woke up, I picked up the receiver. It was a friend from California. And what she told me was, switch on television. I said, what? What are you talking about? It's 6:30 here. And she said, switch on television. There is a political coup in Moscow. There was a presenter there reading this litany of stale, recognizable communist speak.
President Gorbachev has stepped down. He's too sick to do his duties. A new political committee is now in charge of the country.
And I realized that, yes, indeed, something absolutely horrible was happening.
That after years of liberal reform under Gorbachev, a coup was underway. A coup by hardliners determined to take the Soviet Union backwards in time. Away from democracy, back to the old authoritarian days.
My husband by that time, of course, was also awake, and we were standing there in front of the television. I remember we were holding hands. We don't normally do this, you know, standing in front of a television at 6:30 in the morning, holding hands, but it was like he wanted to hold on to something.
Over the next 3 days, the Soviet people were going to live through communism's final reckoning. 3 days that would change the world forever. I'm Lance Bass, and from Kaleidoscope, Exile, and iHeart Podcasts, this is The Last Soviet. In the last episode, we left Sergei Korekalev weighing up the decision of a lifetime. Stay in space and save the galaxy's only space station, or go back home, to Earth, to Moscow, to his wife and daughter. I don't know exactly what was going through his head at the time, but whenever I make a big decision, like when I had to decide whether to train in the Russian space program, it feels like my brain is playing a game of ping pong. Conflicting thoughts bouncing back and forth. Suddenly, you feel like you've reached some clarity, and then a new thought just slams its way in. It's agony. And Sergei had a lot of things to weigh up. First, he had his family to think about. They were prepared for him to leave for 5 months, which was hard enough. But if he stayed, they'd have no idea when Sergei would come home.
Я была очень расстроена.
In a BBC documentary from 1993, Sergei's wife, Yelena, says, "I was so upset. At this point, he was meant to be more than halfway through his five-month mission. In my soul, in my heart, I kept thinking, just a little longer and he'll be back home." All the while, Sergei is concerned about his family's safety. He knows how his country is disintegrating. The poverty, the chaos on the streets. Anything could happen. And it's not just what's happening on the ground that's worrying Sergei. It's also what might happen to him, to his body. Because the thing is, humans aren't actually meant to live in a tin can in space, in zero gravity. Your bones lose density, your muscles weaken. Then there's the space sickness, nausea and dizziness. Your immune system starts to break down. You have trouble sleeping. Few people have been in space longer than 6 months. So Sergei just didn't know what would happen to him. That's Sergei from the same BBC documentary. He says, "First of all, I had to ask myself, do I actually have enough strength to stay? Mentally, physically." Sergei says, "Of course I had doubts." So there were a lot of reasons for Sergei to think, "Actually, I don't want to do this." But perhaps there was something else at the back of Sergei's mind. Because Sergei was dedicated to a dream. The dream of the Soviet Union dominating space.
Her Majesty, her ministers, and all her subjects have been captivated by the charm of Major Yuri Gagarin.
Major Gagarin Yuri Alexeyevich.
Gagarin was Sergei's hero. He was the first one of us, Sergei says. The first to step into the great unknown. And so perhaps the thing he focuses on is that dream of Gagarin, the hero cosmonaut, there to serve the Soviet Union at all costs. Because in the end, that's what Sergei was trained to do. To serve. To do his job. He says he felt in his heart that he could do it. His mind, his body, he was prepared for this. And so he dials into mission control and he tells them, "I will stay. Stay to protect the station and serve my country." But what he didn't know then was that just a month later, everything would change once again.
Good evening. The stunning overthrow of Mikhail Gorbachev by communist hardliners dominates the news this Monday. Gorbachev was reported under house arrest as Soviet tanks took up positions throughout Moscow.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, "Well, I had this career before, but it was a waste." And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At 7 a.m. on the Soviet space station, Sergei Krekalev unhooks himself from his space cot. He doesn't sleep well these days, lying awake for what feels like forever, occasionally falling in and out of frenetic dreams. He floats into the station's main module and gets ready for his daily check-in. But before he has a chance to read out his vitals, Mission Control plays him an urgent broadcast.
Постановление номер один Государственного комитета по чрезвычайному положению в СССР.
President Gorbachev has stepped down. He's too sick to do his duties. A new political committee is now in charge of the country.
What Sergei is hearing is the beginning of a coup by communist hardliners against the president, Mikhail Gorbachev. These hardliners were old school, party bigwigs.
In the bureaucracy, perestroika is designed to take authority away.
Military leaders.
The military is worried about losing its political clout.
And high-ranking members of the KGB.
The secret police are worried they're going to lose political control of the people.
They believed that the Soviet Empire was something to be proud of. In some ways, these guys were the original versions of Vladimir Putin, someone who has written and spoken about restoring Russia to the glory days of the Soviet Union.
He's talked about reuniting the greater Soviet Union.
And now he's been bumping up this Soviet nostalgia.
He was actually all about making Russia great again long before Donald Trump was talking about making America great again by looking backwards.
Back in 1991, the hardliners had the same aim. And so they got together in shadowy backrooms and had whispered conversations about what to do. And eventually, they came up with an idea, a plan to stage a military coup in Moscow. And on August 19th, 1991, they decided it was their time to act.
From ABC, this is a special edition of World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
The first thing they do is lock up Gorbachev at his dacha, or summer house, in Crimea. They put him under house arrest with no communication to the outside world.
There's a lot we know tonight and still a lot we do not know. There's been no word from Mr. Gorbachev, even his specific whereabouts are not known. It is assumed he is not free.
Then they seize the media.
The playing of somber music on Soviet television was one of the first clues here that something had happened. Some people thought someone important had died.
Early in the morning, they order the army to take over the main television tower in the north of Moscow.
Mass media has been taken over by this emergency committee. Newspapers are not answering their phones. Clearly, glasnost openness is under attack.
All scheduled programming is replaced by the ballet Swan Lake on loop. It's interspersed with news flashes. A man in glasses awkwardly reading a prepared statement from a piece of paper. This is what Sergei and millions of other Soviets were hearing that morning. Waiting. Confused. Listening to Tchaikovsky over and over.
Standing in front of a television at 6:30 in the morning, holding hands.
That's Masha Lipman again.
It was like he wanted to hold on to something because the effect, the shock, was immediate and strong. in the sense was that everything that we'll have just lived through, those times of opening up, of freedom, of wild dreams coming true, of old constraints falling apart, that this is about to be over. Both parents, they lived in fear. They unfortunately brought me up in fear. And I dreamt and expected that my children would not grow up in fear. I had such wonderful dreams about them growing up in a free atmosphere. And suddenly it was cut off. It was being taken away from us with that presenter reading from his papers.
But Masha isn't going to give away her children's freedom so easily.
We need to find out whether there would be resistance.
She heads out on the streets. And that's when she sees the tanks.
Mingling with the rush hour traffic, Red Army armored personnel carriers on the streets of Moscow this morning.
Heading south towards the river Moskva, towards the White House, the seat of the Russian parliament.
Tanks from the Soviet
immediately
Army
she has one question on her mind. Would the people join the coup, or would they fight back?
Armored personnel carriers rolled by, carrying scores of troops, some of them brandishing machine guns.
When she reached the parliament, she has her answer.
This was the best street party ever held in Moscow.
Artemy Troitsky is a culture journalist and music critic. But at this moment in time, he was working at an independent TV news channel, a channel that supported democracy. And as soon as he heard news of the coup, he headed out onto the streets.
It was really like a huge political rave. And of course, it was happening round the clock. It was incredible. I've never seen anything like this, neither before nor after.
Tanks lined up in front of the Russian parliament, and stopping them, a huge crowd, shouting, singing songs, saying no, they didn't want to go backwards.
Many gathered around tanks, berating the soldiers. One woman shouted angrily,
"Fascistic!
You are fascists."
They wanted freedom, democracy. They were even trying to block the tanks with their bodies.
One man lay down in front of a tank to try to halt its progress.
They also started to build barricades.
Building makeshift barricades with whatever piece of disused machinery or brickwork was available.
Barricades being made out of cars and buses.
And one crane driver joined the effort, shifting concrete blocks to the delight of the crowd.
Pieces of metal and wood and lanterns.
Helping build the obstacles designed to prevent any army attempt to seize the Russian parliament building.
Of course, they were also having fun. I mean, they communicated, they sang songs, they flirted. The energy was tremendous because on one hand, of course, people, they've been afraid, but they fought this fear.
It was electric. It felt like anything could happen.
Some people were drinking. Indeed, there was some booze, but not a lot of it. Because we got high on other things. We got high on revolution, not on alcohol or grass.
The Soviet people had turned up. They weren't going to roll over and let the tanks take away their dreams of a freer, more open country. But as day turned to night, the party atmosphere started to turn from joy to fear.
Tonight, small groups of Moscovites gathered around bonfires, determined to see what further action the military will take.
And Artemy noticed a sense of dread making its way through the crowd.
I think that there was a great deal of anxiety.
Soldiers have sealed off the Russian parliament. Inside, officials watch nervously.
There were a lot of rumors.
Increasingly certain that Russia's great experiment with democracy has suffered an irreversible blow.
A lot of rumors coming all the time from everywhere. Some rumors were rather frightening, like, you know, there is a KGB division coming to Moscow from somewhere, and they are real killers.
We are told that they fear an attack by military forces loyal to the Committee of Eight.
We've all seen it happen before. In fact, it happened just a couple of years earlier in China.
A brutal massacre of Chinese students and other protesters by the Chinese army.
Where Chinese soldiers shot and killed hundreds of pro-democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square in Beijing.
There was a volley of tear gas. Then, without warning, the army opened up with bullets, firing indiscriminately at the crowd.
As night falls, the people on the streets of Moscow can't help but think maybe this is about to happen to them.
We managed to get a room at a hotel overlooking the barricades and overlooking the White House.
That's Serge Schmimann, the New York Times correspondent we've been hearing from through the series. He has a prime spot overlooking the battle outside the Russian parliament. And what he sees is terrifying.
So then we all realize that these barricades, dramatic as they are, you know, they looked like all these images of revolutions past with flags and slogans, but that they're totally useless against tanks.
The flimsy barricades the people had built were symbolic.
They were going to be there, you know, to protect the future against the past.
And then that night, something happened that made everyone think the past was about to destroy the future.
There are scenes of extraordinary drama here in Moscow tonight. Scenes of destruction, of fire, even of blood on the streets.
Three tanks drove towards the parliament. These tanks were commanded by a guy called Sergei Sorovkin, who until recently was head of the Russian army in Ukraine. To reach the building, they had to get through a narrow underpass.
They were going down an underpass.
And that's when the people attacked. Within minutes, the tanks were surrounded, mobbed by a crowd. They were stuck.
But they got themselves trapped in there.
Young men hurled rocks and Molotov cocktails.
Because they were being pelted by rocks and Molotov cocktails.
Two men climbed on board of one of the tanks. Then
one of the armored personnel carriers caught fire. It then slammed into the barricade.
And as the smoke cleared, three protesters lay dead.
One eyewitness I talked to said that the soldiers opened fire into the crowd and one was definitely shot in the head.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta. visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Soviet space station, Sergei is reading about all this drama on Maggie's bulletin board.
I'd rewrite articles in very simple English. They would connect. It's like my own system was a tiny bulletin board. And they called it RITA, which is my name in Russian. So Rita's information. So I was their information source.
And so he reads the news Maggie sent him.
Tanks in the streets, shots in the night.
He read about an old world represented by tanks and a new one represented by the people.
The people and the security forces has not been seen since the early days of the Russian Revolution.
He read about the violence and the deaths of the protesters.
The Soviet coup turns bloody with three protesters killed.
And the more Sergei read, the more he became charged with injustice. Soviet tanks should not be attacking the Soviet people. It's not in the spirit of the ideals he grew up serving. Ideals that focused on honor and virtue. And by the evening, Sergei had made up his mind. He was going to do something no serving cosmonaut had done before. He was going to make a political statement. And so he wrote a message to send out over the ham radio waves. A message from outer space. His attempt to tell his countrymen, this is where I stand as a cosmonaut. And the message went like this. We stand with Gorbachev. We denounce the coup.
And I think that's a very brave act, what they did.
This is Maggie Iaquinto on an Australian radio show.
Well, because that went out to the world, didn't it? Yes, it certainly did. It was on their space station as a message which could be read by all ham radio operators and which was read by them. And when Gorbachev disappeared, no one knew when he was coming back. And they're left in a fairly precarious position there. And they are dependent on people on Earth. And yet they sided with Gorbachev. And he did come back. Very courageous.
It was courageous because if Gorbachev's side lost, who knew what would happen to Sergei and his family back home? This was a coup. It was reported that coup leaders ordered 250,000 pairs of handcuffs from a factory outside of Moscow in preparation for their victory. The infamous KGB jail was also cleared out, ready to take new prisoners. Those who opposed the coup, especially such high-ranking members of Soviet society as cosmonauts, risked prison by speaking out. Or worse. And at that point, it looked like the coup was going to be successful. Three protesters lay dead. And now a hushed silence fell over the city.
And there were constant rumors, they're coming, they're coming. And all night, people waited for the tanks.
Waited for the tanks that would kill them in their thousands. But the night went on, and the darkness began to lift.
And of course, in Russia in the summer, the night is short.
And as the sun began to rise, an extraordinary scene greeted the protesters.
For a moment, it seemed the situation was out of control. But during the night, the new leadership had lost their nerve.
The soldiers were gone.
The young conscript soldiers on the streets were bewildered. They, too, were victims of this coup.
It was one of the most remarkable feelings because there was no announcement. It was just obvious. This coup had failed. It had failed because nobody joined it.
Not even Sergei. Not even the dedicated communist cosmonaut.
Closeted inside the Kremlin, the acting president, Yanayev, and the other plotters decided they could no longer stay in the city. As they fled down the airport road, it was a humiliation, an extraordinary climb down.
The people had won. And now out in the city, there was a different feeling in the air. a sense that we were entering new, uncharted waters.
It's the feeling I remember most clearly. Tired as hell. Hadn't slept, had napped, and people had made little bonfires around, you know, to cook on. And the bonfires were put out, and people moved slowly. They got up, they gathered up their belongings, whatever they had brought for the vigil.
The vast crowd had gathered to remember three victims of the coup, but in reality, they were recalling how close the country had come to disaster.
The vigil to honor the three dead young men.
And then silence, breathtaking stillness, as the crowd stood to remember and honor the victims of the coup.
And slowly started walking back into the city, smiling, laughing. You know, it was just the feeling of the most pure kind of happiness. There was nothing to say.
There were moments of high emotion, some fighting back tears.
But it was just a beautiful August morning in Moscow, and people were going home because they had defeated this coup.
Many people spoke of this being a funeral not just for the three men, but perhaps for the Communist Party itself.
And that marked a total turning point in then the fate of what was left of the Soviet Union.
Victorious protesters marched through the streets.
A tide of people bringing with them the banner of independence, a huge Russian flag, and shouts of down with the Communist Party.
Tearing down signs at the Communist Party headquarters.
During a day of proud and peaceful attacks on the symbols of Communist Russia.
And scrawling freedom, freedom across the walls of the KGB.
The crowd reveling in the party's humiliation.
Then they reached the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the infamous leader of the Soviet Union's security forces.
By this evening, the demonstrators outside the Lubyanka were preparing to tear down the statue.
There was a noose around his neck.
Next, metal cables were attached to the statue.
The crane actually tore him off.
The journalist Masha Lipman was watching on TV.
And he was dangling in the air for a while.
One elderly Russian in the crowd said, "I lived through lives all my life, but I am glad I lived long enough to see this."
The people had taken back power. And that was only the start of it. All around the Soviet Union, statues of the great heroes of the USSR began falling. Stalins and Lenins and Brezhnevs all over the country.
The attack at Dzerzhinsky was an attack at the KGB. It was an attack at the Soviet regime. It was an attack at the omnipotent government that held its population in fear.
People were no longer scared. And the end of fear really marked the end of the Soviet Union. Within a few months, the hammer and sickle was lowered over the Kremlin and replaced by the now familiar white, blue, and red of the Russian tricolor. For most people, this was a moment of celebration. But for Sergei and the space program, the collapse of the Soviet Union meant they had no idea what their own future looked like. And it's at this point that Maggie, Sergei's friend from Australia, begins to hear rumors. Something is wrong on the space station.
Journalists rang up Sergei's wife and asked her about his illness, which is must have been rather devastating for her to listen to.
And then she heard something even stranger.
They are in space. They're being stranded there. They're being punished. At one point, Sergei said to me in Russian, he says, "They say we are in prison up here."
That's next time on The Last Soviet. The Last Soviet is a Kaleidoscope production in partnership with iHeart Podcast and Exile Media. Produced by Samizdat Audio. And hosted by me, Lance Bass. Executive produced by Kate Osborne and Mangesh Hadakador. With Oz Woloshin and Kostas Linos. From iHeart, executive produced by Katrina Norvell and Nikki Ettore. From Samizdat Audio, our executive producers are Joe Sykes and Dasha Lisitsina. Produced by Asya Fuchs Dasha Litsitsinya, and Joe Sykes. Writing by Lydia Marchant, research by Mika Golubovsky and Molly Schwartz. Music by Will Epstein, theme by Martin Orstrick. Mixing and sound design by Richard Ward. And special thanks to Nando Villa, Alyssa Pollock, Will Pearson, Connell Byrne, Bob Pittman, and Isaac Lee. If you want to hear more shows like this, nothing is more important to the creators here at Kaleidoscope than subscribers, ratings, and reviews. So please spread the love wherever you listen.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.